It's down to Marshall alone, Summer said. He panicked, is all.
Technically, it was a conspiracy, I said. Legally, they all share the blame.
Hard to prosecute.
That's JAGCOR's problem.
It's a weak case. Hard to prove.
They did other stuff, I said. Believe me, Mrs. Kramer getting hit on the head is the least of their worries. I fed the phone again and dialed the chief of staff's office, deep inside the Pentagon. A woman's voice answered. It was a perfect Washington voice. Not high, not low, cultured, elegant, nearly accentless. I guess she was a senior administrator, working late. I guessed she was about 50, blonde, going gray, powder on her face. Write this down, I said to her. I am a military police major called Reacher. I was recently transferred out of Panama and into Fort Byrd, North Carolina. I will be standing at the E-ring checkpoint inside your building at midnight tonight. It is entirely up to the chief of staff whether he meets me there. I paused.
Is that it?
The woman said. Yes, I said, and hung up. I scooped 15 remaining cents back into my pocket, closed the phone book, and wedged it under my arm. Let's go, I said. We drove through the gas station and topped off the tank with $8 worth of gas. Then we headed north.
It's entirely up to the chief of staff whether he meets you there?
Summer said.
What the hell is that about?
We were on I-95, still 3 hours south of D.C. Maybe 2.5 hours with Summer at the wheel. It was full dark and the traffic was heavy. The holiday hangover was gone. The whole world was back at work. There's something heavy duty going on, I said. Why else would Carbone call Brubaker during a party? Anything less than truly amazing could have waited, surely. So it's heavy duty, with heavy duty people involved. Has to be. Who else could have moved 20 special unit MPs around the world all on the same day?
You're a major, she said. So are Franz and Sanchez and all the others. Any colonel could have moved you.
But all the provost marshals were moved, too. They were taken out of the way to give us room to move. And most provost marshals are colonels themselves.
Okay, then. Any brigadier general could have done it.
With forged signatures on the orders?
Anyone can forge a signature.
And hope to get away with it afterwards? No. This whole thing was put together by someone who knew he could act with impunity. Someone untouchable.
The chief of staff?
I shook my head. No, the vice chief, actually, I think. Right now, the vice chief is a guy who came up through the infantry, and we can assume he's a reasonably smart guy. They don't put dummies in that job. I think he saw the signs. He saw the Berlin Wall coming down, and he thought about it, and he realized that pretty soon everything else would be coming down, too. The whole established order.
And?
And he started to worry about some kind of a move by Armored Branch. Something dramatic. Like we said, those guys have got everything to lose. I think the vice chief predicted trouble, and so he moved us all around to get the right people in the right places so we could stop it before it started. And I think he was right to be worried. I think Armored saw the danger coming, and they planned to get a jump on it. They don't want integrated units bossed by infantry officers. They want things the way they were. So I think that Irwin conference was about starting something dramatic, something bad. That's why they were so worried about the agenda getting out.
But change happens. Ultimately, it can't be resisted.
Nobody ever accepts that fact, I said. Nobody ever has, and nobody ever will. Go down to the Navy Yards, and I guarantee you'll find 1 million tons of 50-year-old paper all stored away somewhere saying that battleships can never be replaced and that aircraft carriers are useless pieces of newfangled junk. There'll have been admirals writing 100-page treatises, putting their whole heart and soul into it, swearing blind that their way is the only way. Summer said nothing. I smiled. Well, go back in our records. You'll probably find Kramer's granddad saying that tanks can never replace horses.
What exactly were they planning?
I shrugged. We didn't see the agenda, but we can make some pretty good guesses. Discrediting of key opponents, obviously. Maximum use of dirty laundry. Almost certainly collusion with defense industries. If they could get key manufacturers to say that lightweight armored vehicles can't be made safe, that would help. They could use public propaganda. They could tell people their sons and daughters were going to be sent to war in tin cans that a pea shooter could penetrate. They could try to scare Congress. They could tell them that a C-130 airlift fleet big enough to make a difference would cost hundreds of billions of dollars.
That's just standard issue bitching.
So maybe there's more. We don't know yet. Kramer's heart attack made the whole thing misfire. For now.
Well, you think they'll start it up again?
Wouldn't you? If you had everything to lose? She took one hand off the wheel, rested it in her lap, turned slightly and looked at me. Her eyelids were moving.
So why do you want to see the chief of staff?
She said.
If you're right, then it's the vice chief who's on your side. He brought you here. He's the one who's been protecting you.
Game of chess, I said. Tug of war. Good guy, bad guy. The good guy brought me here, and the bad guy sent Garber away. Harder to move Garber than me. Therefore, the bad guy outranks the good guy. And the only person who outranks the vice chief is the chief himself. They always rotate. We know the vice chief is infantry, therefore we know the chief is armored. Therefore, we know he has a stake.
The chief of staff is a bad guy?
I nodded.
So why demand to see him?
Because we're in the army, Summer, I said. We're supposed to confront our enemies, not our friends. We got quieter and quieter the closer we got to D.C. I knew my strengths and my weaknesses, and I was young enough and bold enough and dumb enough to consider myself any man's equal. But getting in the chief of staff's face was a whole other ballgame. It was a superhuman rank. There was nothing above it. There had been three of them during my years of service, and I'd never met any of them. Never even seen any of them, as far as I could remember. Nor had I ever seen a vice chief, or an assistant secretary, or any other of the smooth breed who moved in those exalted circles. They were a species apart. Something made them different from the rest of us. But they started out the same. I could have been one of them, theoretically. I'd been to West Point, just like they had. But for decades, the Point had been little more than a spit-shined engineering school. To get on the staff track, you had to get sent on somewhere else afterwards, somewhere better. You had to go to George Washington University, or Stanford, or Harvard, or Yale, or MIT, or Princeton, or even somewhere overseas, like Oxford or Cambridge in England. You had to get a Rhodes Scholarship. You had to get a master's or a PhD in economics or politics or international relations. You had to be a White House fellow. That's where my career path diverged. Right after West Point, I looked at myself in the mirror and saw a guy who was better at cracking heads than cracking books. Other people looked and saw the same thing. Pigeonholing starts on day one in the military. So they went their way and I went mine. They went to the E-Ring and the West Wing, and I went to dark, dim-lit alleys in Seoul and Manila. If they came to my turf, they'd be crawling on their bellies. How was I going to do on their turf? Remain to be seen. I'm going in by myself, I said.
You are not,
Summer said. I am, I said. You can call it what you like, advice from a friend or a direct order from a superior officer, but you're staying in the car. That's for sure. I'll handcuff you to the steering wheel if I have to.
We're in this together.
But we're allowed to be intelligent. This isn't like going to see Andrea Norton. This is as risky as it gets. No reason for both of us to go down in flames.
Would you stay in a car if you were me?
I'd hide underneath it, I said. She said nothing. Just drove, as fast as ever. We hit the beltway. Started the long clockwise quarter circle up towards Arlington. Pentagon security was a little tighter than usual. Maybe someone was worried about Noriega's leftover forces staging a 2,000-mile northward penetration. But we got into the parking lot with no trouble at all. It was almost deserted. Summer drove a long, slow circuit and came to rest near the main entrance. She killed the motor and jammed the parking brake on. She did it a little harder than she really needed to. I guess she was making a point. I checked my watch. It was 5 minutes before midnight. "Are we going to argue?" I said. She shrugged.
"Good luck," she said. "And give him hell."
I slid out into the cold, closed the door behind me, and stood still for a second. The bulk of the building loomed up over me in the dark. People said it was the world's largest office complex, and right then I believed them. I started walking. There was a long ramp up to the doors. Then there was a guarded lobby the size of a basketball court. My special unit badge got me through that. Then I headed for the heart of the complex. There were 5 concentric Pentagon-shaped corridors, called rings. Each one of them was protected by a separate checkpoint. My badge was good enough to get me through B, C, and D. Nothing on Earth was going to get me into the E-ring. I stopped outside the final checkpoint and nodded to the guard. He nodded back. He was used to people waiting there. I leaned against the wall. It was smooth painted concrete, and it felt cold and slick. The building was silent. I could hear nothing except water in pipes and the faint rush of forced air heating and the guard's steady breathing. The floors were shined linoleum tile, and they reflected the ceiling fluorescence in a long double image that ran away to a distant vanishing point. I waited. I could see a clock in the guard's booth. It rolled past midnight, past 5 after midnight, then 10 after. I waited. I started to figure my challenge had been ignored. These guys were political. Maybe they played a smarter game than I could conceive. Maybe they had more gloss and sophistication and patience. Maybe I was more than a little bit out of my league. Or maybe the woman with the voice had thrown my message in the trash. I waited. Then at 15 minutes past midnight, I heard faraway heels echoing on the linoleum. Dress shoes, a staccato little rhythm that was part urgent and part relaxed. Like a man who was busy, but not panicked. I couldn't see him. The sound of his heels on the floor was billowing out at me around an angled corner. It ran ahead of him down the deserted corridor like an early warning signal. I listened to the sound and watched the spot where it told me he would appear, which was right where the fluorescent tubes on the ceiling met their reflections in the floor. The sound kept on coming. Then a man stepped around the corner and walked through the flare of light. He kept on walking, straight towards me, the rhythm of his heels unbroken, not slowing, not speeding up, still busy, not panicked. He came closer. He was the chief of staff of the army. He was in formal evening mess dress. He was wearing a short blue jacket nipped in at the waist, blue pants with 2 gold stripes, a bow tie, gold studs and cufflinks, elaborate knots and swirls of gold braid all over his sleeves and his shoulders. He was covered with gold insignia and badges and sashes and miniature versions of his medals. He had a full head of gray hair. He was about 5'9 and 180, exactly average size for the modern army. He got within 10 feet of me, and I snapped to attention and saluted. It was a pure reflex action, like a Catholic meeting the Pope. He didn't salute back. He just looked at me. Maybe there was a protocol that forbade saluting while wearing the evening mess uniform, or while bareheaded in the Pentagon. Or maybe he was just rude. He put his hand out to shake. "Very sorry I'm late," he said. "Good of you to wait. I was at the White House, for a state dinner with some foreign friends." I shook his hand. "Let's go to my office," he said. He led me past the E-ring guard, and we turned left into the corridor and walked a little way. Then we stepped into a suite, and I met the woman with the voice. She looked more or less like I'd predicted, but she sounded even better in person than she had on the phone.